CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. We've got a lot of things to talk about and kind of a disparate list of things to talk about in today's episode. Just before we got started, we were talking about the things that happened since the last episode, i.e., Kate, was last week when we did a Tuesday as opposed to
That's
Wednesday?
Right.
Or is that okay?
Yep.
So it's a little, even a little more time than there normally is between the two episodes. And before we started the episode, we were talking about, remember that Trump immunity thing way back when, a few months ago, when the Supreme Court justices basically let us know that like all bets are off and, Trump should have immunity for everything, and let's not get into January 6th. Let's not distract ourselves with January 6th. This is, the justices need to make the big decision for the ages about whether presidents should be immune. Now, needless to say, that was not months ago. That was like 4 days ago, or not 4 days ago. But I guess it was like 5 days ago, but pretty close, right? But in any case, there's stuff like that that almost seems like old news now, but it was not that long ago. So we're going to talk about those things. We're going to talk about the latest on the actual Trump criminal trial, which quite possible that could be the only one we will see before the election this year. I don't even want to get into the guessing and prediction game about whether it's going to be the only trial. There's certainly a decent chance of that now. But I think, as in so many things these days, there is a competitive, there's a contest that goes on between people to be as cynical as possible. And I mean, there's good reason to be as cynical as possible. Don't get me wrong. But to say like, oh yeah, you think that one of those trials is going to be this year? Yeah. that's totally pre-2016 mentality, dude. Like, are you kidding me? The truth is, we don't know. We could have this Jack Smith trial this year. If I had to bet, I'd bet against it at this point, in large part because of what happened during that hearing last Thursday. But the truth is, we don't know. And it's also okay to say that we don't know about certain things when we don't know. And not be in this kind of, again, there's that kind of one-upsmanship that we are all living within now to not be the person who kind of thought one thing and has to be saying, oh, I guess I was naive to think that or the other. And, you know, some of that came up in the immediate aftermath of that hearing last Thursday. And I'm going to bring in Kate in a moment, since she's the one who actually knows what happened during that hearing, was covering it live for us, as she does basically all of the big court hearings. But one of the things that came up in the immediate aftermath, and this has almost become a kind of a stock piece of the Trump era, is where you get very smart legal academics or legal commentators. And I don't mean the people doing the sort of the frothy stuff on, you know, on some of the ones you see on the cable channels. I mean the really smart people. And I think for anybody who either went to law school or considered going to law school or took the LSATs and then didn't go to law school, I have a very broad understanding of intelligence. There's lots of different kinds of intelligence. But to go to one of those like prestige law schools and get the kind of LSATs that you need to get to do that, you've got to have a pretty high level of a certain kind of intelligence. You know, brain games, figuring out, having the kind of brain that allows you to kind of put together a certain kind of complex arguments. You've got to have that. And my point in getting into that here, and I say this as someone who, you know, was in graduate school and then thought of going to law school and decided against it, but probably figuring into that decision was not getting quite the LSATs I wanted to get. We'd have to get into Josh's personal dramas here. But the relevant point is, these are very smart people. And they're people who really believe in the law, right? They're really bought into this stuff. And it is very hard for those people to see the things that are transpiring in our society today, transpiring in the state of the law today, and kind of be faced with it right in their face. This is all words and talk. This is about power. And they have the six seats, and it doesn't matter what bullshit you learned in law school. And it doesn't matter what great argument you came up with. That doesn't matter. What matters is they have six votes, and that's really all that matters. And seeing those people say, you know what? I was naive here. I thought we were still kind of operating in the sense of these fancy arguments and this thing called the law that changes over time, but is still part of a fabric going back into the past. But no, not really. Right. You have, in addition to what we saw during that hearing on Thursday, and to me, one of the most amazing things was seeing, I think it was Sam Alito, basically saying, hey, look, it is up to us to decide whether presidents are immune from the law. This is a big decision. We need to kind of really think it through. And like, no, it's not. That's not, that is totally not what is supposed to be happening here. We have a case, and you're supposed to decide that case on some theory of what the Constitution or law says. And that might create a framework that will be used in the future. But he was so open at basically saying, this is a policy decision. And me and my friends here were called on to sort of make this policy decision. And that is just absurd. That's not how it's supposed to be. You know, this is just the total indifference to even paying lip service to the idea that this has anything to do with the U.S. Constitution or things tied to the, you know, kind of Anglo-American tradition of common law, because this has been decided. Presidents aren't immune to the law. Even that thing that people talk about a lot, the what is kind of the key semi-controlling DOJ opinion that presidents can't be indicted in office, that's not out of nowhere. There is a decent and I think ultimately correct argument about a prudential argument combined with kind of basic features of common law that you can't indict yourself, which is another one. You also can't be the judge in your own case. It's a contradiction in our system of laws. And the U.S. Constitution, well, does that mean the president is just can do anything? Well, no, because the U.S. Constitution creates this mechanism of impeachment to take the person out of that contradiction of being the judge in his own case, of indicting himself. Impeachment, and that is intentionally vested in the political process. This isn't up to them. And again, the most basic concept of judicial review, the kind of what the literal foundation of it, the cement under the building, what it sits on, is this idea that you have cases and someone has to review the cases, and then case law, since it's the highest court in the land, becomes sort of operative about future issues, okay? So the idea that kind of like, well, this is what are we talking about January 6th for? That's we don't want to kind of get bogged down in the particular. We got to, you know, talk about the general principle. That's not how it works. The whole constraint on judicial review is that it has to operate out of cases. And if you really want to talk about what is supposed to be about conservative jurisprudence, is you're supposed to be just stick to the cases. Not make up new things kind of broadly, kind of like what is the least action we have to take to resolve this issue before us? Anyway, it's a corrupt court. These people are thoroughly corrupt, and it is always quaint and in its own way kind of sad to see people who have not realized that. And it's sad because these are people who've dedicated themselves to a vision of what the law is. And it's, you know, kind of inherently difficult to see what it has devolved into. So that is my little speech. Kate, tell us what happened in that hearing, the immunity hearing.
So, I mean, like you kind of alluded to in the intro, I think the conventional wisdom going in was they've already thrown Trump all kinds of little gifts here, right? That includes taking it up at all, not just letting the DC circuit be the last word. That includes taking, you know, weeks to respond at every juncture, taking weeks to schedule the oral argument, you know, now potentially taking weeks to hand down a decision. All of that was accumulative.
The first thing of not taking Smith up on it when he said, hey, this
right,
is, we got to move quick.
In December.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a cumulative, you know, the moment they started oral arguments, that was a 4-month gift to Donald Trump. That was 4 months of delay that they had enabled on this one spoke of the January 6th case. You know, we haven't even gotten into the merits yet. But I think the conventional wisdom was they did all that. That's bad. You could still have the plausible deniability of, well, these courts move slowly and the Supreme Court should have the last word on issues of this level of import. And okay, fine. Pretty much as soon as the arguments started, though, it became really clear that we were not headed for a place where they were going to say DC Circuit was right, you know, rubber stamp that, kind of back down to the district court to proceed on the merits and get going. And even in that version of events, it seemed pretty unlikely that the whole gamut of the appellate process would wrap up before November. But at least it wasn't kind of 100% egregiously, obviously, them just carrying water for Trump. But during the arguments, I mean, kind of right off the bat, you had the biggest indicator that things were not going well for Smith was John Roberts pretty openly saying he didn't like the DC Circuit's opinion, that he was displeased that they had kind of come to a conclusion of, well, we reject the Trump theory that absolute immunity attaches to official acts, so we don't really need to sift through the indictment and figure out what's an official act and what's a private act. So, you know, we're not going to bother with that. This theory is no good, and that's that. He was really displeased by that. And that was a common thread for all the conservatives saying, we need to draw lines around what's what here. And all of that drives in the direction of, well, we're going to send it back to the district court to let the two sides kind of fight it out on what's an official act, what's a private act, separate those, and then start from there. So an additional level of full gamut of the appellate process on just the immunity spoke still. And that is kind of where the brunt of the court seems to be. It seems like we're going to get some kind of outcome that's like that, but somewhat further. I mean, some on the right clearly felt that this whole prosecution was unconstitutional and would have been down with just dismissing it altogether. But I didn't quite get the sense that that Roberts or Barrett would go along with that.
Can I ask you there, is it on the kind of like throw this out entirely? Did you get the sense that that went beyond Thomas and Alito? I guess Kavanaugh, well, you tell me, is it?
Yeah, Gorsuch didn't like it. Gorsuch might have joined that train. Kavanaugh was pretty aggro for him, which was another early sign that this wasn't going to go Smith's way because, you know, you can't really afford to lose Kavanaugh in a case where the liberals are going to win. So, you know, Barrett was kind of the most interesting conservative here because she put Trump's lawyer on the spot and said, okay, we read off charge by charge in the indictment and said, is this an official act or a private act? Official or private? Official or private? And then she kind of circled back when the DOJ lawyer was up and said, how do you want to proceed? You know, here are your options. Either we're going to drop this back down to the district court and have them sift through, figure out what's what, or would you be content with just kind of accepting what Trump's lawyer divided each charge and then proceeding with the trial from there? So, you know, letting Trump's team kind of be the one who is deciding what charges Trump could be charged on. But the bonus is you just keep going, right? You don't have to like go back down and kind of do all this immunity sifting. And he was like, yeah, I'll take the latter, basically, because by this point in the arguments, it was pretty clear that was, if that was even possible. And I'm not at all sure that kind of Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, the crazies would let that happen, that that was the best possible outcome for Smith by that point.
Wait, the best possible outcome to basically let Trump just throw out as many charges as he wanted and at least get to the trial, or the reverse?
Or at least, if not just let Trump be the decider, at least cut down on the back and forth between which acts are which. You know, I want to kind of clean up what I just said in terms of, I don't think that the DOJ would just be like, yeah, sure, Trump, like you pick which charges you want to be kind of called on. But, you know,
well, I guess there's a kind of a chicken game here of put Trump on the spot. Okay, which do you think? And then there's kind of a like a silent auction, as it were, kind of. Yeah.
And, you know, the DOJ guy kind of interceded in terms of like, well, you know, we want to make the case that some of these that they're saying, no, you know, that's an official act was in fact private, but, you know, still seemed inclined to kind of perhaps lose some charges, have some fall off in the name of speed and getting to kind of just keep moving ahead. And that makes sense with what the kind of premise of this has been from the beginning, which is if this argument or if this trial doesn't get started or end before November and Trump wins, I mean, guess what, buddy? You're not getting any of those charges. So right, it's not the worst case scenario here.
Right. Part of this goes to the nature of the American presidency. And if you look at partly if you look at the way political scientists have looked at it, but even more if you look at it historically, it is in some ways, kind of a pre-modern office. And when I say that, pre-modern can mean a lot of different things, but it is really a kind of a creature of the 18th century in the sense that it is a personal office inherently. It's very different from a prime ministership in the sort of the Westminster parliamentary system, that it is, in many ways, it is modeled off of 18th century monarchy in the sense that the president has certain powers that are inherent in his will. That's why you have things like the ability to pardon or many of the president's powers are like that. They are vested in that person for a specific period of time. And you know, the way that most other political offices that came into existence at a later period are more circumscribed and have the official and personal things that the occupant of the office does be more clearly distinguishable. But again, that's really not how the U.S. presidency works. Everything the president does is official because the president's acts have power that is inherent in the person. It's kind of a complicated issue to fully air here. But I don't see how the way the U.S. presidency works, you can make that decision at all. And in practice, it makes any kind of legal accountability meaningless because the things that you need to worry about are abuse of the powers. Like Trump, you know, just it got really mad one time and killed Steve Bannon during one of their conversations. Now, presumably there you would say, this isn't a matter of the presidency. He just wigged out and killed the guy. So that's not an official act. And okay, you know, that's great. But like a presidential murder, they shouldn't be immune from it. But that is a private thing. And kind of in the grand scheme of things, doesn't matter that much. It's just another murder. Right? The things you care about are the president using his powers to stay in office illegally or doing the kind. So even the concept is off because, again, it's the only thing we really care about is doing things wrong with the official in an official capacity.
And when you drill down on this case specifically, it kind of takes on another layer of absurdity, which is the Constitution purposely kind of boxes the president out from the electoral certification process because there used to be no term limits. So it was assumed that the president would probably be one of the people running. So you really don't want him involved in the process, right? I mean, we have the electors and Congress certifies that and the vice president plays a role, but the president is kind of explicitly like, you're not part of this. Like you're awaiting the results of the election back in your, you know, whatever 18th century hotel room. And so, you know, kind of making that into a piece where, you know, oh, this was everything he was doing on January 6th was part of his official duties. Well, he pretty much has no official duties about certifying the election. So it's even harder to make that case, you know, and there are just threads like that just shot throughout that the conservatives had to work really hard to kind of muddy up because it's just so obvious. It's so crazy to be sitting there kind of spinning a historic yarn about what the framers wanted when like the one thing we know they were really concerned about was a monarchy, right? Was a king who's unbounded by any kind of accountability. And that's where we ended up in this really kind of incoherent place where it's like, well, the only punishment is impeachment, right? Which on its face, it's like, okay, pretty small potatoes for like staging a military coup. But then Trump's people are like, well, if he's impeached and convicted, you know, then he can be criminally prosecuted. And that just completely undermines their entire argument, all of which is a president can never be criminally prosecuted. You know, it's just they kind of toss that in to be like, well, no, don't worry about it. He can if he's bad enough, you know?
But the justices didn't seem to bite on that one, right? They didn't. That was not something they were into. That idea that you need to be impeached is that right? Is that that?
Yeah, they didn't. Really
that was really just
much,
the Trump argument.
Yeah, they didn't spend much time on that. I mean, where they spent almost all of their time was just, this will make it impossible for presidents to do their job. You know, it'll chill conduct. All of the former presidents or all the current presidents will go after the former ones and prosecute them. It'll turn us into a banana republic and kind of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I thought Ketanji Brown Jackson was like far away the most effective liberal, but you know, she would intercede and be like, presidents have always assumed that they could be prosecuted, like from the beginning of time until now. So why would this be just such a sea change in the way they would act, except if you get some, you know, wannabe fascists like Trump in office who, you know, blatantly wants to use the power in a corrupt way. So, and she was really the other liberals did too, but she was the most consistent one kind of saying, you guys are so worried about bumming out the president and maybe kind of making him think there are some constraints on what he can do in office. Shouldn't we be really concerned about the opposite, that we're going to have emboldened presidents who know that they can just do anything under the imprimatur of their office without any, you know, without having to worry at all? Like, at worst, you know, you get impeached and convicted. That's not so bad.
Yeah, it's, you know, that is a feature, not a bug. That is right. Literally the whole point. You want presidents to think about, I better not do anything that is illegal because I could be prosecuted in the future. That's, we all live under that, right? I mean, like if I go out and I get mad at someone, I don't shoot them because it's gonna, you know, the fact that I could be prosecuted for murder chills my behavior. That's right. That's living in society, right? That's the point. And you know, the point you made about, you know, what the president was doing in his office on January 4th or January 5th or January 6th and kind of twiddling his thumbs because he doesn't have anything. He's not, you know, the Constitution doesn't prescribe a role, is another way of kind of making the point about what the presidency is. Just being there, he's presidenting because he's the president and he doesn't need to have a prescribed role. Because again, he's the president. It's, you know, most city councilmen or aldermen or whatever, their offices are designed in such a way that it's obvious that when they're at home having dinner, they're not aldermaning. They're just a regular person, right? And so that's not official acts because they're only aldermen when they kind of put on the alderman clothes at work and do these specific things. They're chairing, you know, they're gaveling in the meeting and stuff like that. President doesn't work that way. Everything he does, he's president. And again, that is something built into the office and is because the office was created in the 18th century when you didn't really have these ideas of didn't have quite the same ideas as of, you know, kind of magistrates who have, you know, kind of limited set of responsibilities, blah, 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 blah. It's pretty not upsetting in the sense that I expect different from these justices. But again, that has always been that chilling. We want that chilling. And even, you know, because I sometimes people say, well, what if Biden is indicted? What if Trump wins? Trump becomes president, and then he indicts Biden. And my response to that is like, I certainly hope that doesn't happen, but Biden's a grown-up. You know, I'm not saying it's no big deal, but like, and I would hope, and I think, in fact, that he knows that might happen. And he's enough of a grown-up and enough of a patriot that if that's where it's going to go, we'll deal with that when we get to it because we know the world we're living in. And I don't know, if we as the American people sort of give you the keys, you know, you can be the president, there might be some downsides to that. I want you to kind of say like, you know, yeah, a future president could abuse his office and, you know, there's jury trial, so hopefully I won't be convicted, but they could certainly make my life really unpleasant. I'm going to say, like, I want you to accept that that's a possibility, right? Again, and that doesn't mean it's good, but it goes back to the earlier point. I mean, look, we know that there is a certain percentage chance that presidents get assassinated because people are crazy and they are sort of drawn like moths to a flame to the power of the presidency. And if you run for president, I think we all understand that you just kind of take that on. You know, it's one of the risks of the job. And that's just a risk of this job. And that's why I fully expect if, God forbid, Biden loses and Trump becomes president again, he's not going to run off to like Dubai or I don't know, Taiwan or who, I don't know, where does the U.S. president, you know, go to seek asylum? I expect him to stay right here in the United States because he's an American. And we don't run away. You know, we kind of, we stick with the work of this country, even if power is abused. So it's just, it's such a crazy concept. And, well, it's just a crazy concept. I'm not sure it requires any more belaboring than that.
Sotomayor had like a pretty poignant little passage that's really similar to what you just said, where she was like, you know, we have a system and it's not perfect and we make a lot of mistakes, but we get more right than we get wrong. And kind of part of living the whole, you know, American experiment is having faith that the system will work, you know, while kind of working to fix it. And I thought it was stark in this moment where, you know, all of the conservative justices were basically saying, you know, if former presidents were indicted, right, like were put up against a jury trial, I mean, they weren't even entertaining the possibility that he could have a fair hearing in that case, that a jury could identify a president acting on nothing more than vindictiveness and kind of going after a political rival, right? I mean, these people are the top of the system and they have absolutely zero faith in it.
Yeah, no, it's really awful. And there's, and it goes, you know, people are very, understandably, very kind of worked up about this particular situation. And I think the, you know, the best, you were talking about before that many of us assumed the way they operate, this court operates, is they will give the GOP, they will give the Trump everything they can within, except when it just makes them look absurd. Mm-hmm. Right? They'll throw him every bone. And many of us assumed, I kind of assumed, that we'd hit that limit with this. They delayed it 6 months. You know, they did him a real solid, but now we're kind of at the end of that. But yeah, I you know, there's, I be making the same point again, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So let's catch up a little bit on the Trump trial. Last we spoke, it was, we had Pecker on the stand, who has been on the stand for a few days since we talked about it last pod. We have the kind of weaving of the story of how the catch and kill process worked, the details. Pecker talked a lot about the McDougal catch and kill. He had a lot of kind of firsthand experience there. He had somewhat less, to the prosecution's chagrin, about Stormy Daniels, because towards the beginning of that interaction, he said, well, we're not paying for it. This is, you know, this is a lot of money. They just did a big McDougal thing. You know, we're not in for this one, which of course is how we get to the place where Cohen has to pay out of his own pocket and get reimbursed. And so Pecker kind of led up to the line of that, but had a little bit less to say about the machinations of how that specific interaction worked, because again, he said, we're not going to pay it, and Cohen got pissed about it. But they're also kind of getting into the atmospherics of the Access Hollywood tape, of the idea that bad Trump interaction with women stuff was especially poisonous at this juncture in the race, and that they desperately needed nothing else to come out about it. So that's kind of where the universe of where we are with the testimony. And we've had a few people since, you know, some lawyers, Trump's assistant, to kind of shore up, you know, he had these women's number in his phone book and he would check in on how the situation's going. You know, like he asked Pecker, you know, when Pecker came to the Rose Garden for, you know, an official little White House visit, that Trump asked him, you know, how's Karen doing, and trying to suss out if she was going to keep her mouth shut or not. And then we also had, late last week, this flare up in terms of Trump's gag order, because he has been, you know, talking with reporters on his way in and out every day. He's been truth socialing. He's been keeping up what he always does, you know, the this is a witch hunt, kind of going after specific witnesses, going after Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. And the prosecution is like, look, man, to the judge, this guy is under a gag order and he's breaking it left, right, and sideways. You know, something needs to be done. And the judge basically said, you know, kind of gave out what limited fines you can give out to Trump, while also being very candid that he wasn't satisfied with the idea of these like $1,000 fines per violation, saying, you know, this isn't much of anything when Trump can easily afford that. And I don't want to let him off scot-free, essentially, and said blatantly, you know, you will be put in jail if you don't stop doing this. So we've kind of touched on this before, this idea of it feels like Trump's going to keep calling his bluff. And at some point he might actually either risk looking like kind of a powerless idiot with no control over his court, or swallow putting Trump in jail, you know. But we hit this first inflection point where I think most people are still kind of like, well, it makes sense to have restraint up until this point, right? We're only a few days into this. You don't want to go kind of DEFCON 4 like right off the bat. But I think it's also a notable, you know, slot in the timeline of like, here's where the judge was like, listen, pal, I'm not going to let you just get away with this. And then when we inevitably hit the next critical mass of Trump trying to get away with it, he's going to look progressively stupider if he's like, and here's another, you know, $10,000 in fines or whatever.
It does. How much is our understanding? Like, how much did he box himself in? Like, because in my understanding, he didn't say the next time you do this, you are going to jail, period. But as you allude to, you know, he kind of said something like that, kind of basically saying, look, I know you can pay. This is like, for you, this is like fining you a quarter. Doesn't matter. You're happy to pay these forever. And if you keep doing it, I'm going to send you to jail. So he kind of did box himself in, it seems like. I don't know. I'm kind of starting to think he is going to put him in jail if he does this. Because I don't, you know, look, I don't know anything about this judge beyond, you know, what has happened in this trial so far. And you get an impression of just the person and previous cases and blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't sound like someone who gets played with. I don't know. That's my impression of the judge. Now, there's being played with in the sort of the ordinary just trials in New York State versus like a presidential campaign. But I don't know. He seems fairly no nonsense.
Yeah. More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show. Yeah, I agree with that. And I thought, you know, the prosecutors really tried to do the whole, like, he went after your daughter thing, right? Like, put him in irons right now. And I thought he was pretty tempered about it all, you know, and he also kind of cleared up any remaining plausible deniability from the Trump team of being like, well, how could he possibly know that a retweet was an endorsement, you know, and he kind of cleared that away. So I think this first standoff, I think it was resolved correctly. Like, he has to put down his marker in the sand. He has to at least pretend to entertain the ignorance of the Trump team. And it's pretty hard to see how we get into this place again. And he's like, this
one
is
more
your
try.
Second
yeah,
strike, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. And it's just a crazy place that we're at.
And I think it's interesting too, because one of Josh's most recent dispatches talked about this kind of quote, Michael Cohen sized hole. And it's going the way that we thought it would, where you have all these people who are kind of like can talk about Cohen, right? Can talk about, can maybe like soften the ground with some of his credibility issues, with some of his temperamental issues. You know, we've had some of the lawyers talking about how he's just like a unpleasant, pissy guy who would get really mad and, you know, kind of blow up at you and everything like that. But also, you're starting to kind of shape a story where he had to pay out of his own pocket. And that was unusual. And that's not how this went and how Trump was mad at Pecker, because he kind of is breaking off the way that they usually do things, right? So they're kind of like tiptoeing up to the precipice. And we're obviously going to need Cohen to fill in the details. But we've talked about this before, that the prosecution's biggest problem is that their case is so reliant on Cohen and he's so problematic as a witness. And I have been, I think it's notable the degree to which these kind of peripheral characters are able to at least form up a narrative where your common sense kind of drives you to this place, even if they're not able to say conclusively, you know, I have a recording of Cohen telling Trump, pay me back for killing the Stormy Daniels thing, but creating a network where you're like, this is how it always worked. Cohen was pissed that he had to deal with the story himself. You know, Trump with the House Karen doing thing, right? Like he was involved. He was kind of keeping track of where these stories were and how big of a threat to him that they posed. So when Cohen comes,
yeah,
you've already built up all the scaffolding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I mean, there's one part of this that is just so funny. I can't remember. What was the amount that he paid, that Cohen, like $150,000,
$160,000? Yeah, something like that.
It's in that ballpark. Yeah. It's you know, kind of certainly in terms of orders of magnitude. It's just always, I mean, this is just part of being, you know, being rich, I guess. But it's always seemed so funny to me that like he's pissed. But this would be sort of like, I don't know, you know, we go out to dinner together and you forget your wallet and I got to pay the whole thing. Or like, I don't know, I've got to drive someone somewhere. I'm so mad. But this is like, I had to pay $150,000.
Right.
Like, that's such a funny thing in itself that you're totally kind of like, I'm so pissed. Yeah, whereas normally for most people, that's, oh, $150,000. That's my home down payment. Or that's my net worth now that I'm doing well.
That's more money than I've ever made. Yeah,
exactly. It's such a funny thing. But the other thing with Cohen, and I don't know, I guess it's a problem just because of reasonable doubt. But what has always struck me as the fail safe is just, what else was he doing? Like, okay, yes, he's a total liar and just liar and bully and bad person, but what else was he doing? What other thing could he possibly have been doing? Was he setting up Trump? I don't know, to laying a trap for him? Or I guess there was actually, did you see this thing where OAN had to retract a story? Did you see this?
I did.
So my understanding of this, for our listeners, if you don't know about OAN, it's one of these kind of, you know, Fox clone networks that became prominent in the last year of Trump's presidency and then became really big in the, you know, the sort of the big lie period. You know, it's up there with like, what is the thing of, you know, the weekly tabloid, the supermarket tabloids that are like three steps below the Inquirer kind of thing.
Right.
I guess that they ran a story suggesting that Cohen was having the affair with Stormy Daniels. And, you know, so that's the what else he was doing. Cohen did it. And he was paying off Stormy. So I don't know. So she wouldn't go public about Cohen. Like, anybody cares about that? Right. So in any case, they had to retract that story. And it's sort of one of these funny things because I didn't even know that was a thing.
Right.
It's sort of like the, you go to professional wrestling and the guy says, hey, I'm not really mad at Joe the Stomper here. And I didn't actually cut his head open and he's not bleeding. None of this is true. So I guess that was, you know, maybe that's the theory. But I come back to the case. What else was he doing?
Yeah. And that's the place where I think the Karen McDougal stuff is really useful, because it's so similar to the Stormy Daniels thing. And you just have lots of evidence that this is how the machinery worked. They were all used to it. Trump was like very, very micromanage-y of how it went. You know, there's no world in which he would be this concerned about Karen McDougal and then be like, Stormy, that'll be fine, right? That'll be a blip on the horizon. The porn star is going to be way easier to swallow than the playmate. So, yeah, I mean, it's driving to this place of like, obviously this is what happened, you know, and all the defense is really doing, you know, they're still not really doing what we discussed before, kind of creating an alternate theory of the case. It's more just trying to like muddy, trying to do a whole, this isn't a crime. It's, you know, you're being prudish if you think this is unsightly. This is just New York, you know? So, but I do think, I mean, this is what we talked about before, that I think that's a harder position to take the second you step out of opening arguments and you have to start dealing with fact patterns, you know? It's just, what's going to be easier for a juror to follow? Kind of the straightforward narrative story that the prosecution is crafting, or just obfuscation from the defense, right? I mean, if they're successful, it'll do enough to kind of unravel the narrative that you stop following it. But I just think as a lay person, a straight narrative is easier to kind of get your hands around than just tangent that I'm hoping to just kind of like overwhelm you with.
Well, I think also that it's a pretty straightforward narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very understandable. You know, sometimes with financial crimes, there are all these things about you have to understand the sort of the technicalities of certain kind of, you know, business interactions and corporate structures and all this kind of stuff. But everybody gets like, he did it with Stormy and that's going to be pretty bad. And so he had to pay her some money. Okay.
Right.
That processes.
Got it.
Got it. So it's pretty straightforward to understand. I was going to say, you know, many of us have understood that way of operating that he has for a while, because we've been following this coverage forever. Obviously, the point is that the jurors are not supposed to be that deep into the story. And obviously, not everybody is as much as we are. But again, getting some embarrassing marital situation, got to pay some money to make everybody be quiet. Everybody understands that. That's
right.
Everybody gets that.
And there was a bit of an interesting period with Pecker where the prosecution was saying, you know, did you get the sense that he wanted to cover up the affairs, you know, to spare his wife, to kind of spare his family? And Pecker's like, nah, it was pretty obviously about his campaign. So, you know, there goes the kind of Trump is a family man argument just kind of goes out the window.
You know, there's another thing that is just so, I don't know, slice of life entertaining for me about the story that we are hearing, that, again, in the normal world, if someone said, what about if you, here's a crazy idea. What if you pay off my mistresses? What do you think? Most people would say like, dude, what? Like, oh, what? But we know that Pecker was basically willing to say, okay, I get the logic. I hear where you're coming from. That works for me. But at a certain point, he's like, you guys are really piling it on here. You're really loading me up. And I'm not doing everything. And I am just fascinated by that plot development, mm-hmm. right? He was willing to pay off the mistresses. But at a certain point, he's thinking like, I was thinking two or three. And now we're talking six or seven. And who am I? Am I a chump? This is too much. You've got to take care of that one by yourself, right? And this is, I guess, this is sort of human interest in the world of mogul catch and kill, right? Everybody's got their limit. Right. And that was the thing. And that's why Michael Cohen got all upset because, now I've got to pay the $150,000.
Right.
So mad.
Exactly.
But yeah, slice of life.
So we're going to end with a little bit of a grab bag section here. We're recording on Wednesday. Maybe even by the time we're off, we're expecting the Arizona State Senate to finish repealing the 1864 abortion ban, which I'm sure listeners remember the Arizona State Supreme Court just greenlit a few weeks ago. Republicans were immediately so panicked about what this would do to their electoral prospects that you had, you know, the likes of Donald Trump and Carrie Lake for the limited time she could stay on message saying, you know, we got to do something about this. You know, we can't risk losing Arizona to, you know, some angry harpies. So they kind of went back to the legislature. There were a few false starts in the House. Ultimately, the House repealed it last week. So they only meet on Wednesdays right now. So this is the first chance the Senate will get to repeal it. It's expected that they will. It's likely that the 1864 ban could still go live for some amount of time because the repeal doesn't go into effect until 90 days after the legislature gavels out. They're still doing budget stuff, so we don't know when that's going to end. The AG is kind of doing some machinations where she's asking the state Supreme Court to stay the effect of their ruling for 90 days so she can consider, you know, petitioning for cert at the U.S. Supreme Court, which obviously she's not going to do. She's just trying to kind of keep it off the books until the repeal can go through. But that's where we are now, which is creating this kind of interesting tension where Democrats are scrambling to try to not lose the electoral juice of this 1864 ban, but they know that they can't really just say that because that sounds ghoulish to be like, oh God, I really wish we could have had some more, you know, bodies mounded up before this went away. And it was funny because I was on a Biden campaign press call on Tuesday, and it was like, every speaker said some version of the exact same thing, which was, we hope this gets repealed, but if it does, we still have an extreme abortion ban in Arizona. You know, there's still a 15-week ban, and you still have no idea what other ban could come down the pike based on, you know, who is in power in the state. And all that's true. But it's interesting to kind of watch them try to re-triangulate to keep people scared, right? To like keep people incentivized to come vote for the ballot initiative and thereby incentivize them to vote for Biden and Gallego and everyone down ballot.
Yeah. I mean, I think they can to a significant extent, but there's no question that this takes some of the ferocity out of it. And just to bring listeners back up, you know, up to speed in the backstory of how we got here. Before Katie Hobbs became governor, the previous governor, Doug Ducey, with the Republican legislature, they passed a 15-week ban. So the whole thing with the Supreme Court was, are they going, like, is that 15-week ban that was just passed, you know, 2 years ago or whatever it was, is that going to be the law now that Roe was overturned? Or are we going to go all the way back to this 1864 one? And certainly Republicans were hoping, let's do the semi-normal one to not put too much pressure on ourselves. But that was why it was such a shock that the state Supreme Court said, nope, we're going to go back to the 1864, even though that kind of turns on its head how everything works. New laws supersede old laws, but that's what it, and again, the difference between ban from conception to ban to 15 weeks, I mean, 15 weeks is bad, but the vast majority of abortions happen within 15 weeks. The vast majority, something like 90-95% or something like that. So it's a big, big difference. And it is certainly the case that it would have had, you know, dramatically more impact on the ground in Arizona if abortion was totally banned. And I believe it was only for, the only exception was life of the mother. But as we know, life of the mother ends up being a lot flimsier in practice than it seems in theory, because you get a lot of situations where they're like, you don't seem dead yet to me. You know, let's play this out kind of stories. And, you know, you have that case of the woman in Texas where it's not just if you die, it's maybe you become infertile. Maybe you lose a limb. I mean, there's all sorts of things that can happen, obviously. It does seem to me that you do have the kind of the absolute ban, the fact that you almost had an absolute ban kind of in the water now, as it were, right? That people kind of know the sort of the stakes of this. I don't know the specifics of the, I guess it's a 2022 law, but those laws often also have a lot of de facto kind of making it really hard to get an abortion kind of things, even though technically you can have one in the first 15 weeks. So it's still, I think that referendum is still going to be a pretty big deal, but there's no question that it takes, as I said, it takes a real amount of the ferocity out of the situation. And it's certainly, now, two issues here. One is that if it goes into effect for 90 days, or, you know, if you have 90 days of an absolute ban, that's going to be a pretty big deal. We're only like, what are we, 6 months away from, you know, from the election. The other part of this, though, and this is kind of an oddity, but a little more than an oddity. One of the members of the state Supreme Court in Arizona is this guy, Clint Bolick. Now, a friend of mine pointed this out to me couple weeks ago. And, you know, I hadn't been keeping track about who the people on this Arizona Supreme Court are. I mean, you know, these aren't household names for me or people I'm going to remember from something that happened before. But Clint Bolick, I do remember. He was a big guy way back into the 90s, Republican politics in DC, you know, kind of the vast right-wing conspiracy era. Right. So, and, you know, Federalist Society, all that kind of stuff. He was appointed by Doug Ducey, the former Republican governor. He's, I believe, up for election, or they call it retainment or something. They've got this system. You get appointed, but you got to show up on the ballot every few years to kind of get the, you know, get the blessing of the voters to remain remain on the ballot. So I thought, okay, you know, that's interesting. How'd he turn up there? You know, they're kind of, Doug Ducey was sort of stalking the Supreme Court. His wife is in the Senate, Shauna Bolick. She is one of the people who is going to vote for the repeal of the 1864 thing. So that's kind of interesting on a few different levels. The Bollicks are pretty right wing, and Shauna Bolick was deep in the Arizona, you know, the Arizona franchise of the coup, with all the fake electors stuff and, you know, all that stuff. She was deep into that. What I found out today is she was actually appointed, which is, you know, doesn't really matter. I mean, people get appointed to these offices when someone resigns. Someone resigned, and like the Maricopa County, I don't know, Board of Supervisors or something like that, it's up to them to appoint. So she's there and she's defected. And Kate and I were talking about before the episode, like, you know, isn't she pretty anti-abortion rights? She's pretty crazy. You know, she's got the sort of the Trump big lie stuff. Obviously, coups and anti-abortion rights don't always line up, right? You've got some sort of like freak flag types in the big lie community, I guess. But she has done, and I guess what I'm curious about is my read of at least Clint Bolick and, you know, maybe his wife too, is that they're fundamentally political people more than they are ideologues. And I think we have seen with many Republicans, they're kind of like, hey, I always want to be there for the fetuses, but we've got an election to win here. So like, sorry, we got to, you know, can't help you this time. And I'm curious whether that's where, you know, where that's where she's coming from.
Yeah, totally. And it's why the fall starts in either house. You know, it took a few weeks for them to get here. I thought were so mind-boggling, baffling. You know, like this one is like politics 101. It is obvious that this is not good for you. And, you know, are you going to piss off some anti-abortion people? Yeah, but, you know, you're a homer for the 15-week ban, so no one's going to go around accusing you of being, you know, an ally to women. So, you know, I was almost, the biggest question to me was like, if Republicans, especially state Republicans in Arizona, which was long the kind of cradle of Republican craziness, even though I think Florida's duking them out for that one now. But if they were at all, I mean, political anymore, to the point where they could act in their own political interest, if that drove against just the kind of crush to the right at all times, you know, if they lost that sense of self-preservation, you know, I mean, you see this like on the federal level in the U.S. House all the time. It's obvious who comes from an R plus 30 district, because they would rather fire Mike Johnson and not make any kind of a plan, but because their instinct is always just driving in the way of be as extreme right wing as possible. Like, that is the only directive you ever have to follow. And even here, where, you know, maybe the state senator from district whatever is fine, is safe, it doesn't matter.
He still wants to be in the majority.
Yeah. Plus, most of these guys, or at least a lot of these people, have greater ambitions than being on the state level. And so you would at least think that would kind of like loop in your interest in having a Republican president and a Republican Congress, and, you know, not being like the sole agitator to the RNC or whatnot. But, you know, and it seems that they've gotten here in the end, but that muscle memory is weak. You know, I mean, gerrymandering is a hell of a drug.
Yeah. Well, I guess the other thing I wonder, though, is, are we sure that the Arizona Supreme Court is going to, you know, get along and go along and say, OK, you won, we'll give you the stay, blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean,
definitely not on that point.
Because why? I mean, at a certain level, I'm not even sure on the merits, what would be the argument for a stay? I mean, I don't understand what legal argument you could make, like, OK, well, we're repealing it, so why not just repeal it early? Like,
she's,
what? That
she's saying
make sense.
Unconstitutional vagueness is why they would appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, I mean, we all know what she's doing, right? This is just a delay tactic. So, yeah. No, I'm not at all sure that the state Supreme Court is going to go along. I can't imagine that they've loved having everyone in their political camp for the past few weeks being like, you idiots.
Right.
Losing everything for us.
Yeah. No, I mean, maybe, you know, look, maybe that will. Well, I also wonder, like, is Clint Bolick, right? I mean, it's certainly not the case that spouses all are always conferring and kind of, you know, get in, you know, have a common opinion. But, you know, in the real world, that kind of is sort of how things work. So I don't, and what was it? It was 4-3, but then there was another kind of nut bar who actually recused himself because he
that's right.
called like abortion genocide or something.
That's correct. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I don't know how, I mean, there's a lot of things to deal with in Arizona Republican land, but it certainly doesn't, but again, it doesn't, even if they want to make this go away, it's very hard. If you have a sympathetic audience, you might say like, okay, you're going to appeal it to the Supreme Court and get our abortion ban overturned there. Got it. Okay. Yep. Wink, wink. But obviously you don't have a sympathetic audience there. And like, I don't know. It just seems like it would make them seem stupid. And again, even on the merits, I don't even know what the argument would be. It's clearly not going to win. You usually do stays because it is, you know, you don't want to foreclose. You don't want to create facts on the ground, but there's no chance of a win. So even there, that's something that I think in the way that this kind of jurisprudence works, it's not like the people being asked for a stay can't look at that. Right? That they can't say like, there is zero chance of your phony appeal winning. So why are we doing a stay here? That makes no sense. I don't know. It is true. We do need to look clearly at the fact that we're talking about at least a 90-day period when a woman who just needs an abortion would at least have to go out of the state, which you know, that's real. That's real world stuff there. And I don't know. It's a complicated situation, I guess, is obvious.
So we're going to end with this news that was reported pretty clearly, purposefully leaked to the Associated Press, that DEA is kind of homing in on rescheduling cannabis from what it is now, Schedule 1, kind of the most big, bad, and intense, scary drugs, to Schedule 3. This is like, basically every time you get at least two beers in me, I'm like, you know what's going to happen. They're going to reschedule weed right before the election. And that's always going to get the youths back. I mean, this has seemed like so obvious to me for forever. And I still kind of think that they're going to wait to drop the hammer for real until like October. And this is just kind of the ground softening to get it into the bloodstream and, you know, get all the like angry opposition stuff kind of out now, so that, you know, in October they can kind of drop like the bomb and have a whole schedule of events about, you know, from the social justice angle. And you've also got Biden just did, you know, a batch of clemencies, and they were all kind of like nonviolent drug stuff. So they're clearly setting up the scaffolding, I think, for the big announcement here. And the kind of visible orchestration of it is a little bit funny, because, you know, they have to maintain, oh no, this is just how government works. You know, it's just, well, what a coincidence. But, you know, this is also something that I would say, it's not like they've come out of left field about it. Like, I mean, it's funny to think of Joe Biden as like the warrior for legalizing cannabis, but they've been talking about this in the way that is, you know, the new kind of center of the Democratic Party, which is, it's no longer just kind of a progressive thing. Like, your everyday rank and file Democrat is going to say, you know, crackdown on cannabis is only used against Black and brown people, and look at all the states. And, you know, we clearly as a country and a culture have moved on this issue. And it's really just kind of the federal government that's dragging its feet. And that's been in the works, you know, from the Biden administration for a long time. But yeah, we now seem like poised for an opportunistic, big change in drug policy on this.
And so the current, whichever the schedule it is, my understanding is it is currently on this, in the same group as like heroin and cocaine.
That's right.
You know, highly addictive and quite easy to kill yourself with drugs. Mm-hmm. And so what is the, and at least my understanding is, you reschedule it, and it's not just that it's, you know, no longer classified with those, that there are all sorts of knock-on effects about, you know, how you can use the banking system and all these kind of other things that go on with it. But what is that that less onerous scheduling, and what other kind of things are in that?
So part of this too, by rescheduling it, would be recognizing its medical benefits, which is a piece. So, you know, it wouldn't be kind of going full scale like recreational, but it would ease the tax burden, which is like a huge thing right now. It's really, really taxed. It would make it easier to do clinical studies on cannabis, which are like totally lacking, because you can't really do it with Schedule One drugs.
Yeah, on I don't know if I don't know specifically about the banking stuff, but I know, as you say, that it is coming off a scheduling where the government basically says, it's not worth trying to study if it's good for some disease. This is such a dangerous drug. We're not even going to go there. And while I don't know the details about the administrative and banking stuff, that it basically moves it to a classification of drugs where we're not worried if someone's growing it in another country, and we're not, there's all sorts of things that it just, the government no longer cares about. And those kind of things are, you know, are a very big deal, not because necessarily it has an immediate effect on what you can do in a already pot legalized state, but that it has these knock-on effects in the economy and foreign policy. So it's a big deal. And you know, one thing to, this is kind of going on a tangent, it does kind of remind you, as much as this is a good thing, but thinking forward to a potential second Trump administration, is that a lot of things the president can just sort of do, right? And that's cool if it's like it's doing this thing, you know, loosening the strictures on marijuana. But there are a lot of the modern American state creates a lot of decision making that it is supposed to go through these processes and public comment periods and this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, the president has it largely within his or her power to just say, yep, we're doing it. You know, we're going to reschedule a bunch of, you know, kind of career employees and make them political appointees. Yep, I'm feeling it. That's what we're doing. So it is a reminder that this is good in this case, but we have invested a lot of latent power in the presidency that if you have a really rogue president can go in some pretty, in some pretty worrisome directions.
Yeah, totally. And just to kind of end with a sense, you know, some other drugs that would be on this new tier with cannabis would be like steroids and testosterone. So, I mean, things that can be abused, but you wouldn't, think of those in your
purposes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you wouldn't think of that in the category of, you know, heroin and LSD and the other drugs that pretty much everyone except for like right-wing psychos for a long time has been like, well, this is silly, you know, this doesn't belong here.
Yeah, no, there's no question that even if you think that marijuana should be illegal or heavily restricted, the idea that it is the equivalent of heroin has always been absurd, as you say.
Yeah.
And everybody has always understood that makes no sense.
Totally. And it's just gotten so increasingly absurd given kind of the state layout right now. I mean, you've got, it's not just kind of the brightest blue states who have, you know, now medical and recreational markets. I mean, it's kind of all over the place. And it's just, it has always been a little bit strange that something like cannabis that has all these, you know, medical uses that is so kind of, you think of it when you think of like cancer patients or kind of veterans struggling after their service and everything. So, I mean, it's one of those things that's like, obvious at this point, and it's good that he's doing it. And you know what? If it helps him get reelected, more power to you, Joe.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like the dynamics were different. It's a bit like gay marriage in the sense that by the time the Supreme Court got into the case, it was kind of already a largely won issue, and many states had done it or were in the process of doing it, and the Supreme Court just sort of, you know, made it kind of ended the question. And in this case, you know, you have certain very conservative states that are still there. Although in some of those states, you have a lot of libertarian leanings where they kind of, you know, like maybe some of those Intermountain states. But even the states that don't have it, in a lot of cases, you know, it's relatively new in New York State, but that's kind of because of just some political sort of idiosyncrasies. It wasn't like there was like a groundswell against pot or something like that in New York State. So even the states that don't have it now, it's kind of the writing's on the wall. Like, what are we doing here? It's just maybe they don't have a referendum process, or, you know, you haven't gotten some trifecta to make it work or something like that. So in any case, it is at a minimum, even for people who are not crazy about marijuana or marijuana use, I think everybody kind of realizes like it's not something to spend time like busting people over. That's just a waste of time. I think that is an overwhelming belief at this point. And where you get certain people still disagreeing is like, we still shouldn't encourage it. Its use. It's not great. It's blah, 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 blah. And that's where there's still some public debate. But again, on the sort of like, do we put like a quarter of the police budget into busting people for using stuff? Like what? Like that just, I think that does seem like absurd to, rightly absurd to a lot of people now. So, a lot of quality content, a lot of stuff we got through. We will be back for another episode next week. I guess that's all we got. Yeah?
That's right. Yep.
All right. Later.
Later. The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.